Amen. Good morning. How are you? Let me see if I can get this. Yeah, that's not going to work. Is it too heavy or what? Well, let's see if we can do it again. Oh, there it stayed. Well, good morning. My name is Tom Ellenbaugh. If we haven't met, I'm usually this awkward when I come up here. Okay, I'm getting rid of that. I'm just going to do this in a minute. If we haven't met, I am, as Abby mentioned, I'm the senior pastor of Harbor Churches, and I was just realizing that it was, I think like 18 years ago this weekend, that I was at a retreat center on the east side of the state, and I received a call from somebody at Fairhaven Ministries asking if I would entertain a position of spiritual formation at Fairhaven Ministries. And so I moved here towards, I guess, the summer 18 years ago and became spiritual formation pastor there. And then about 5 years later, I planted South Harbor Church, one of our sites in Byron Center, the kind of our first site that we had. And then we became multi-site after that, and I became senior pastor about 3 years after that. So if you've been around for a while and we haven't met, I've been around a while, but so you know a little bit about me, I don't have a congregation. My congregation's really our staff, and then I guess all of you in some ways, but I'm really connected to our staff now, and I don't serve a particular church. But a couple things just about me as a person, like I love missions, and I love church planting and church multiplication. So if you're interested in any of the stuff we're doing there, I'd love to sit down with you and talk to you about that. If you have any questions about how Harbor Churches works, I'd love to sit down with you one-on-one and just connect around those things. I also love being a pastor. And over the last several years, as the senior pastor of this kind of larger organization. Now, I don't have as much pastoral connection to individuals as I used to have because I don't have a specific congregation. So if there's something that I say this morning that connects with you and you'd like to connect with me, I would love to connect. I would love to talk one-on-one. I'd love to be your pastor. I'm not your direct pastor. That's Scott and Ben and Abby and the staff here. But I also can be your pastor and your friend. Live here in Jamestown. Have lived here since I moved here. And so that's just a little bit about me. We're going to jump into scripture this morning. Again, we've been in a series, long series, 40 weeks we're going to be in the book of Genesis, and we've broken that down into some smaller kind of chunks and pieces. And some of you have the devotional that we've been working through day by day. Some of you have just been coming and you've been engaging in the different series, and we're coming. We've just kind of finished a series, and then we're in what we call kind of a practical week. We try to take a point between each different sort of mini series, and we try to have a week that we call in practice, where we say, hey, we've been talking about this for the last 4 or 5 weeks. We try to be practical in all of our sermons, but specifically this kind of week, we try to be even more practical and say, hey, how can we take a next step? How can we take that next step in our faith and move into something new, maybe get some concrete handle? So we've been talking about family trauma through the life of Isaac and his wider family in the book of Genesis, and there's a lot of interesting stories there and interesting trauma. We're going to go back now to Genesis 21. So in this In Practice week, we kind of bounce around. Sometimes we'll go to the New Testament. I'm actually going to stay in Genesis today, and I want to go back a little bit to Genesis 21, and I want to talk about some trauma that we see there, and I want to dig in a little further to that trauma that we see in not certainly the life of Isaac, but actually the people around Isaac in his life. Some of you have been through some significant stuff that has traumatized you. Some of you done it to yourself. You grew a mullet and had parachute pants in the 80s. No, I'm kidding. There's actually more serious. That was a traumatic experience for me. I never really could break dance well. I mean, I tried, but it never worked. But we've been through some serious stuff, honestly, haven't we? I mean, I know because I'm a pastor and I sit one-on-one with you and I hear some of your stories that you don't want to share with other people. And I've heard some of those stories of abuse, stories of addiction, stories of loss, stories of broken relationships. And the thing is, those stories aren't just stories that we read in a book or a novel somewhere. They're the stories that shape our lives, and they shape our character, and they shape who we are and who we become. The brokenness in our lives that comes from all these different things that happen to us in our lives, unfortunately, produces often more brokenness. Others of you, you know, some of you had really, really deep trauma in your life. Others of you, you're like, well, I really haven't had any trauma in my life. Because there's this lie that we tell ourselves that because somebody else has had worse trauma than us, that our trauma isn't that big a deal. But that's just a lie, because the reality is there's always someone who's had something worse and always someone who's had something better. At least it looks that way, right? But we don't really know, because we only live in our bodies. We only live in our lives. So just push that lie away, because your thinking does matter. And that's a lie that you've been told, that your trauma is not that important, if that's one of the lies that you tell yourself. I want to just make this claim this morning, that pain shapes how we see the world. Pain shapes how we see the world. It's like, I often talk about the lenses we wear. I've started to lose my eyesight a little bit as I get a little bit older. Some of you had this earlier in life. I'm just hitting it now. And I realize that, all of a sudden I can see clearly, right? But I can also put on glasses that make me see differently. And we put on all kinds of glasses as we read the Bible. We put on all kinds of glasses as we read the culture. We put on all kinds of glasses as we read our own lives. And pain is one of the kinds of spectacles we put on through which we see the world that we live. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, from the pain that we experience from trauma, how it becomes the glasses we see the world. Now, before I fully get started here, I have a caveat. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychotherapist. Okay? I've done some pastoral counseling. I've taken some classes on that, read a lot of books on it, but I'm not a psychotherapist. And so if you are out there and you're like, Tom, stop talking about trauma because it's a clinical diagnosis, okay? We're talking about trauma as a part of that clinical diagnosis, but something more than that as well, right? So please hear me. I'm not using a clinical diagnosis for this today as we talk about trauma. Here's a kind of a definition that I just have in my head around this. Trauma is an external event that overwhelms an individual's ability to cope with the situation. Okay? Something happens to you. A loved one is tragically killed in a car accident. You find out that you have cancer. Someone abuses you. Something external is happening to you that suddenly you find yourself in a spot where you don't know how to cope, or you can't cope, and you're struggling with coping. Let me tell you a story from when I was a kid. It's a simple story. But so when I grew up, and I think it's true now too, playing T-ball was a big deal, you know, and so I loved T-ball. You know, we had the tee and we put the ball in. We had a big field by our house, and me and the neighborhood guys, we would play all the time. We played T-ball all the time. I loved it. And I wasn't bad at it. I was okay at it. And I think I played second base most of the time when I was on teams and all that kind of stuff. And just had a really good, I had a great T-ball career. We'll call it that, okay? Had a great T-ball career. Then came fast pitch, okay? Fast pitch. And when you take young kids and give them a hard baseball and tell them to throw it as fast as they can, there's some dangerous stuff that happens, right? Because they're not that accurate yet. So we switched from T-ball to fastball. And I remember exactly where I was. Behind Zealand Christian, there were some ball fields there when I was a kid. And if you've ever been to Eintema Funeral Home in Zealand, there's the Langland brothers, if you know the Langland brothers. I'm not sure which Langland brother it was. I tried to figure it out this week, but I'm not exactly sure. But one of them caused trauma in my life. And here's what happened. I was wearing a helmet, because my mom was just meticulous about helmets. I had a helmet on, and Steve or Mike, the fastest pitcher in the league. And he was striking out everybody, right? And so I get up, and I'm confident, I'm ready to go. And he throws this incredible fastball, and as I'm watching it come, I'm like, it's coming towards my head. And I remember kind of leaning back like this. And there's this on the baseball helmets, they have this little thing where it kind of goes like this and then around your ear. There's like a spot right there that the ball can still hit. And I kind of leaned back, and the ball hit me like right there. The next thing I remember is waking up with people over top of me. Like, are you okay? Are you okay? I actually had stitch marks in my head from the ball. Knocked me completely out. Now, here's what happened after that. I was terrible at baseball from then on out. I couldn't play anymore. I was actually pretty good before that, but I was afraid of the ball. From then on, from that day on, even today, like you know, playing catch with my kids when they're younger. Like, I'm trying to be all dad, and I'm like, I hope they don't throw it too fast. Because there's something, like, that happened traumatic in my brain, right? Something external happened, and it caused something that became the lens through which I saw the world. So now baseball was a dangerous thing. It's a single event that changed some things for me. Now, that's just baseball. Trauma can happen from a baseball hitting you in the head, and it can happen from the abuse from a loved one. All kinds of things can happen to us. So I want you to be thinking about it. I know Scott has asked you to kind of name your trauma or name some traumas in your life, and I want you to, I know they're hard to bring up, but I want you to hold on to those this morning. Here's what I'm going to do this morning. I want to look at this Genesis story in Genesis 21, and I want to show you three responses in one story to trauma from which I think we can learn some practical application. Then I want to share with you a doorway into healing. We're going to step into the next series we're going to step into is a forgiveness series. And so we're stepping, to move past trauma, you have to move into some forgiveness. Like, I'm still mad at the Antimus. No, I'm kidding, I'm not. But you do have to move into some forgiveness, right? We're going to move into that, and I'm going to talk about a doorway into that today. And then I'm going to give you some even more, I think, practical, like, next step things you can tangibly do, okay? Can we move forward with that? Okay, so Genesis 21, I'm going to break the story into three pieces so I can show you three people, three responses, and talk about some ways that we can look differently at that. Okay, so Genesis 21, read verses 8 to 10. The child, this is Isaac, grew and was weaned. Remember, Isaac, it took a long time for Abraham and Sarah to have kids, 100 years old or so. Finally, Sarah gets pregnant, Isaac is born. And on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast, big celebration with all the people around, right? But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had born to Abraham was mocking. Now, if you don't know the story or remember the story, God made a promise that they were going to have children and they were going to be, that Abraham and Sarah were going to be the father and mother of generations, but then they went a long time without having children. So they decided that Abraham should sleep with his slave, Sarah's servant girl, and have a child with her, and they had the child Ishmael, and that caused obviously some family tensions. So they're having this celebration when Isaac is weaned, and Sarah, instead of enjoying the celebration, turns her eyes towards Hagar and Ishmael and says, I can't celebrate because of that, all right? But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had born to Abraham was mocking, and she said to Abraham, get rid of that slave woman and her son, for that woman's son will never sharing the inheritance with my son, Isaac. Okay, so the first response in this story is this one, lenses. Trauma can rob us of joy. You see it in Sarah's life, right? There's this moment. I mean, they've been waiting for this forever. They've been waiting for Isaac, and they've been promised Isaac, and they've been praying, and they've given up hope, and then they've got hope back again, and finally Isaac is born, And Abraham had a great feast, but, there's a little but in there. It's actually a big one, isn't it? But Sarah can't celebrate. Why? Because the trauma of what's happened with Hagar and the trauma of waiting so long to have a child, the trauma of all those things has made it impossible for her to even celebrate. I think a little bit about this little sidebar, but Luke 15, there's a story of the prodigal son, we call it, and the younger son goes off and he spends his father's inheritance and then he comes back and the father says these beautiful words. He says, we had to celebrate because your brother was dead and is now alive. Your brother, he's speaking to the eldest son. But what's the eldest son doing? He's a little bit like Sarah, isn't he? He can't celebrate for some reason. We don't know the story of the elder son. We don't know what he went through. We don't know why he can't celebrate. Same thing. Something has happened in the life of the elder son that's caused him to be blinded to the joy that's right before him. He can't participate in the joy. He just can't get there. There's this scarcity mentality in him, or this bitterness or resentment or anger, something that's a deep root in his heart. And it's created a toxicity that's poisoned the fruit of the Spirit in his heart. Do you hear that? You see, trauma, if we drink it and we live it, poisons the fruit of the Spirit in our heart. We can't experience the fruit of the Spirit like joy. Joy is one of the fruit of the Spirit. And that's what's happening with Sarah here too, right? There's something that's gone toxic in her heart. And to be fair, probably for good reason. Like if I put myself in Sarah's shoes, you know, her husband, multiple times in the story, if you've been with us, you know, the last couple of months, multiple times introduces her as his sister, wanting me to acknowledge her as his wife. Then he sleeps with another woman, has a child with another woman, and not only includes that child in his home and blesses that child, he also includes that woman in his home. Imagine what it felt like for Sarah every day to look at Hagar, to see Hagar combing her hair, to see Hagar playing with her child, to see Hagar maybe flirting with her husband Abraham, or even seeing Abraham go into her tent to watch her laugh and have joy. And Sarah continues to drink the bitterness of her trauma, and so her joy ends up shriveling inside of her. The fruit of the Spirit of joy is destroyed in many ways in her heart. And after waiting all these years, it's finally Sarah's turn, right? She has a beautiful child in Isaac. God has answered her prayers. And we don't see her celebrate. It's just a but, right? Abraham has a great feast, but Sarah can't get there. She can't get there because the trauma that's resulted in the bitter root of unforgiven rage and envy burns like a deep fire in the recesses of her heart, like hot coals about to flame up. And she does. She flames up, right? And she says, get rid of that servant girl. I'm not going to celebrate until she's gone. And that kid will not share in Isaac's inheritance. Sarah's brokenness that results from her trauma colors the way that she sees the world, and she's unable to move forward into the goodness right in front of her. She literally cannot celebrate. I've been dwelling on Psalm 37 recently, and as I kind of was studying this, Psalm 37 came to mind. I think it's going to come on the screen here. Here's David. It's just the first part of his psalm. Notice this. He says, do not fret because of those who are evil, or be envious of those who do wrong. For like the grass, they'll soon wither. Like green plants, they'll soon die. Instead, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Take delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Notice the juxtaposition. He's saying, don't pay attention to all the stuff that's happened to you from the bad guys. Trust in the Lord. And then if you read the rest of the psalm, it's quite long. The rest of it's all about the bad guys. It's almost like David's trying to convince himself, right? He knows in his head that it's true, that he needs to trust in God and do good, but he's like, but the bad guys. Don't think about them. He's like self-coaching himself, right? Because he's experiencing a lot of the same thing. Let's be careful, because I don't want to blame Sarah here. She has real trauma. She's been horribly mistreated. She's been made second place. She's been overlooked. She's been used. She's been abused. But I want you to notice what happens. And I think this phrase I'm going to say right now will come up on the screen. Sarah's trauma becomes the lens through which she views the world, allowing it to poison her ability to celebrate and experience the joy of this long-awaited son. God does answer his promises. God does answer her deep need. Not in her timing, not in the way she wanted. But when he does, she can't even see it because she's put on a different kind of glasses. So what can we learn from Sarah here? I think it's this. When we find ourselves unable to experience joy because of those external circumstances that have happened to us, we often have been impacted by a real trauma. If you're at a point where someone's having the celebration, you should be celebrating, you know it in your head, but you can't because there's bitterness and anger. You're like the elder son, you're like Sarah, and you're like, I know I should be celebrating, but I feel the deep coals of hurt and pain in my soul. Pay attention. Put a bookmark there. I'm going to come back to that in a little bit because the flip side of that is the question, what does God want in your life? Jesus says in John 10:10, and maybe you've heard this a lot of times, that Jesus says, I've come to give you life, and life abundantly, life to the full, like all the good stuff. I can imagine Jesus speaking to Sarah and saying, I came to give you a son. I came to give you joy. I came to give you love and all these things. And she's like, not feeling it. There's something going on in her emotions. Jesus wants us to experience life, but sometimes our trauma gets in the way. Paul, if you read the New Testament, you read Paul, Paul often talks about this too. He says, even though you suffer persecution, even though you're inwardly dying or things are happening to you or the external body's being persecuted, he says, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, right? Paul's dealing with the same thing, right? He's being persecuted in all kinds of ways by external circumstances, by the Romans, by those, the Jews who are against Jesus. Like all this stuff is happening. And he says, all this suffering, all this trauma, but consider it pure joy. Lean into the fruit of the Spirit, Paul says. You see, we can react one way and we can choose to move a different way. The good news this morning, the gospel message, if you will, is that through faith and through the resources of our faith and through the transformative and resurrection power of our real God who has come in the person of Jesus Christ, we can overcome the debilitating joy killers of our traumatic experiences. You hear me? I hope that good news comes through. It may take you a while to get there. But the good news of Jesus, of Paul, all throughout the scriptures, the good news of the whole story is that despite the traumatic experiences in our life, with the resources of our faith and the power of the resurrection, we can overcome the debilitating joy killers of our traumatic experiences. And you may not believe that. And that's okay. But maybe trust me today. Maybe trust some people around you today and say, maybe there is an open door for it. Well, let's keep going. Second response in the trauma, verse 11. The matter distressed Abraham greatly because it concerned his son, right? She's saying, get rid of Ishmael, is his son as well. But God said to him, do not be so distressed about this boy and your slave woman. Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the slave into a nation also, because he is your offspring. No, there's a promise there, isn't there? Early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He sat them on her shoulders and then sent her off with the boy. She went on her way and wandered in the desert of Beersheba. Second response is that trauma can multiply trauma. Trauma can multiply trauma. Unless it's a natural disaster, an illness, an accident, or something not caused by another person in our lives, much of our trauma comes from somebody, doesn't it? And most of our trauma, honestly, comes from someone who is close to us. In fact, often the greatest trauma comes from the people who are the closest to us. Sometimes it's unintentional, and we're traumatized by people's stupidity or foolishness or neglect. Sometimes it's an unfortunate side effect of something that has happened. For instance, many of us have been traumatized by dysfunctional relationships of our parents, right? We've been a part of a family in which our parents were dysfunctional, and we carry the trauma of that. In fact, they probably carry it from the dysfunction of their parents, and it comes down from generations. It's probably not intentional, and yet it's real trauma, right? What's interesting about this part of Abraham's story is that Abraham doesn't know what to do. Imagine being Abraham in this moment. Wife and son, or slave woman and son. Wife and son. Get rid of her and son. I mean, it's a tough spot, certainly, right? He's already done all kinds of things he shouldn't have done. He's gotten himself in a predicament that he shouldn't be in. There's really no good choice here. I don't know that the choice he made is a good choice. I don't think it's actually necessarily what God would have wanted. God does say, listen to Sarah. But maybe he could have done that differently. But he gives her water and he sends her on her way into the desert. Now think about this. In this time, in this cultural situation, if you were a woman who wasn't married, especially a woman who wasn't married, who had a child, who had had relations with your master's husband, your life was already on the line. So now to be sent into the desert like that alone, she has no protection, she has nothing to take care of her. He sends her into a traumatizing experience. Sometimes we meet trauma with trauma. Abraham's on the spot, there's trauma that's already happened in the family, he makes another bad decision and he heaps trauma on trauma. He adds trauma on trauma. Trauma multiplies. Sometimes when we try to help the traumatized, we do more trauma to them. You've probably heard this phrase, hurt people hurt people. Hurt people hurt people. I have a little DC thing up here, you know, with the Joker. You know, part of the interesting thing about DC Comics is they're playing with this idea, right, that each person who is an evil person actually is a traumatized person. Interesting. Even the heroes and the anti-heroes in the stories are people who've been traumatized. And there's a big question, I think, throughout the DC world. What's the difference, actually, between Batman and the Joker? Both have been traumatized. They've gone different directions. We're not going to get into the theory of DC tonight, but or this morning. But hurt people, right? We hurt people on purpose and by accident. Abraham was a broken guy. He was as broken as the next guy. We look at him as the hero of the faith because he did have faith in God and he trusted God. But he made all kinds of bad decisions that hurt Isaac, that hurt Sarah, that hurt Hagar. He was just as much a sinner as the next guy. He hurt people just like the next guy. You know, I keep hearing this language of bad guys and good guys, and the reality is there's not much of a difference, honestly. Because we all sin and fall short of the glory of God. Maybe at different degrees, maybe in different ways, but we are all sinners. We have all hurt ourselves and we've hurt other people. We hurt the people we don't understand. We hurt the people who are different than us. We hurt our friends. We hurt our families. We hurt our neighbors. We hurt our spouses. We hurt our children. We sin against one another. Intentionally and unintentionally, and we cause trauma, just like Abraham did. We multiply trauma on trauma. So here's Abraham's response. Maybe he thought about it, but maybe he had an alternative. This is why Jesus says, walk in the way of love. For love covers a multitude of sins, right? Love covers a multitude of traumas. It's important not to multiply trauma on trauma. In fact, one of the things that we see throughout the scriptures that's really interesting is that trauma is passed on from generation to generation, and sin is passed on from generation to generation. You see generational sin. You see it in the story of Abraham and Isaac. Isaac has some of the same sins of his father. You see it with David and Solomon. Solomon has some of the same sins multiplied of his father. That's why it's really important to pay attention to your trauma and take a different road. And not multiply trauma on trauma and stop the cycle of generational sin. Okay, third thing, and so I can get to, through to the final practical stuff. Last story, verse 15. When the water in the skin was gone, so Hagar goes out into the desert with Ishmael. She's just got some water. She's got Ishmael. She's as good as dead in terms of the culture. That's how she sees it. That's how I would see it. When the water in the skin was gone, she put the boy under one of the bushes. Then she went off and sat down about a bow shot away, for she thought, cannot watch the boy die. And as she sat there, she began to sob. God heard the boy crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what's the matter, Hagar? Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy as he grew up. He lived in the desert and became an archer. While he was living in the desert of Paran, his mother got a wife for him from Egypt. So the third thing that happens here is that trauma can blind us to hope. Let me ask you a question. The well with the water, when was that dug? I mean, did it just all of a sudden show up? Like, did an angel come and dig it while they were sitting under the tree? Probably not. I mean, I suppose that could happen. It doesn't say it in the story. My guess is from the text, the well was already there. The well of water was already there, but Hagar was so traumatized and so focused on her trauma that she wasn't able to see hope. She was blinded to the hope right before. There was water right there. But it took an act of God to open her eyes to see that the water was there. There was hope for a future. And God had made promises already to Ishmael and to her. And those promises were already there, but her trauma blinded her to hope. Trauma can act like blinders, keeping us from seeing the possibility and a different future. I wonder, to turn it to you and I, when you are so focused on your trauma, what might you be blinding yourself to? Might there be some open doors that you just can't see because you're so focused on that trauma? So how do we open our eyes to hope? So three things that I think are helpful for us to look at in this story. How are we like Sarah and missing the joy? How are we like Abraham multiplying trauma on trauma? And how are we like Hagar not opening our eyes to the possible hope all around us? And those may not be as practical as you like, but they're practical. I've got a few more practical things to move us forward. But here's another thing I want to talk about. This is a doorway to hope that I want to, a doorway to hope and healing I want to offer to you this morning. Because the doorway to hope and healing in Christianity is not something that always makes sense, but it's real. Now, Doug McClintock, who some of you know, and he's preached here before, he's one of our missionaries right now in Europe, doing church planting in Europe. Doug was here a couple weeks ago, and he met with our staff, and he gave a talk, and it was just after Easter. And he said that Christianity is built upon a post-traumatic resurrection event. Christianity is a post-traumatic religion. Now, just sit with that for a minute. What's interesting about the gospel of Jesus Christ is that Jesus meets suffering with his own suffering, and God brings healing through the shared suffering of Jesus. Jesus joins us in our trauma and in our suffering. And somehow, Jesus moves through that suffering to the place of resurrection and new life. The post-traumatic experience of Christianity is not to live in the joy-killing, trauma-multiplying, hopeless place of normal trauma. It is going through to a place of resurrection. You see, when Jesus goes through the suffering of the cross, when Jesus dies and is buried for 3 days, when Jesus overcomes sin and the grave and has victory in the resurrection, somehow, the trauma of the cross becomes the reconciling work of God for joy and hope and restoration. Now, I don't understand that any better than you do. I don't know how to make sense of that. I don't know how it works. But I do know it's true. I've experienced it in my own life. That going through that and allowing the blood of Jesus Christ and his death to cover the trauma that I've been through and to participate in the resurrection truth on the other side of trauma is what the gospel is about. Instead of allowing the trauma to rob him of joy, instead of multiplying trauma through violence against others, instead of being blinded by trauma to hope, for the joy set before him, Hebrews 12 says, Jesus endured the trauma of the cross, scorning its shame, and overcame sin and death and all of the accompanying trauma. I don't understand it, to be honest. I can't explain it any better than I have tried to for the last 25 years in all of my preaching. But with all my heart, I know that the doorway to healing, the healing path for the pain of trauma, is through the cross of Jesus Christ and his powerful resurrection. And so here's an important question. And it may not seem practical, but I think it's one of the most practical questions I can give you is this. What does it mean to fix your eyes on Jesus when you face the suffering of the trauma you have experienced? That's, again, fix your eyes on Jesus comes from that Hebrew passage. It says that Jesus, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, overcame, and so then the writer of Hebrews says, so fix your eyes on Jesus. What does it mean? What would it mean for you to fix your eyes on Jesus in the midst of your trauma? I think there are some ways. And again, if this resonates with you, I would love to sit down with you. Someone here would love to sit down with you. We'd love to walk through that with you. Because there is resurrection on the other side of trauma. Let me give you a couple practice things now, and then I'll close, okay? Some very, I think, specific practice things. The first thing is this, that emotions tell a story. Emotions tell a story. I see a counselor very regularly. Started years and years ago. And I talk with that counselor about the things going on in my life. And I remember a time when my counselor said to me, well, how do you feel about that? And I said something like, well, I think things are going to get better. Or no, I feel things are going to get better. And he said, that's not a feeling. I said, yes, it is. I feel things are going to get better. And he said, that's not a feeling. He said, if you can take the word feel and pull it out of the sentence and put think in it, it's not a feeling. I'm like, that's dumb. Try it sometime. So he said to me, how about something like this? Like, I feel hopeful. Okay, that's a little different. There's a reason I'm telling you this, by the way. We'll get to it. I feel like he's just not listening to me. Well, actually, no, I think he's not listening to me. I feel dismissed and ignored. Do you see the difference? So here's what my counselor did. Like, we went round and round and round and round this, and I literally am so bad at recognizing my emotions. I'm better now. So bad at recognizing my feelings that he opened his drawer and pulled out a piece of paper and gave it to me and said, pick a word. And he had a whole bunch of feeling words on the paper. And I had to learn to recognize my emotions and my feelings, because often our emotions and our feelings point us to what we're longing for and help us to find God in a different way. Because we recognize, I'm feeling ignored and dismissed. Well, that's something I can talk to God about. God, I'm feeling ignored. Oh, I recognize you. I'm the God who sees you. Hagar tells us that, right? I'm the God who sees you. There's some things I can go to God with. There's a thing called the feelings wheel. I think I've got a kind of a picture here. You won't be able to see. Do I have a picture of that? Yeah, feelings wheel. I don't know if you've seen this. For those of you who are like me, men in the room, is that okay to say? Men in the room, women too. But if you need help articulating your feelings, this has been really helpful for me. There's a version of this that actually has come through our children's ministries material and our student ministries materials, where I first came across it, better than the sheet of paper my counselor had. And what it has is feelings to articulate. There's actually emojis, which is nice. But then it has feelings, and then you go one deeper feeling and then one deeper feeling to figure out, like, what am I actually feeling? It's really, really helpful to articulate what's going on in me. What am I feeling? Not what did Tracy do, right? Not what did my husband do? Not what did the guy at work do, right? But like, what am I feeling? What am I feeling? Because your emotions help uncover your eyes and help you be able to cry out to God about what has happened because of the trauma you've experienced. Your feelings and your emotions from the pain you've experienced are real. And wrestling with those is really important. And they become or can become a pathway to God. Now, that's a long journey. Like, you're not going to figure this out tomorrow. If this is new to you, like really articulating your feelings, first of all, and then figuring out how your feelings become a pathway to God, that's a journey. That's a long journey. It's an important journey. It's a healing journey. I'd love for you to get on the journey. It's a good one. Secondly, recognize your feelings. By the way, if you want that color wheel, you can just Google it. I also have like 100 copies of these at the connecting point. So if you want to take one home with you, grab one. They're really great, by the way, to use with your kids, to get your kids to actually articulate how they're feeling. Have them point. Have them figure out the colors. What are you feeling right now? Okay, second is this one. Alone doesn't work. Alone doesn't work. And we'll just go through all these. They're up there. Alone doesn't work. You cannot do this alone. You have to talk it out. You have to have someone listen to you. You have to have someone pray with you. You have to have someone believe for you when you don't believe. Alone doesn't work. You have to do this in community. That's what the church is for. We're here for each other. A mentor, a spiritual partner or friend, a small group, a counselor, a therapist, a pastor. Don't do this alone. Invite someone into your trauma. As scary as it is to admit it, you have to. You have to move through healing. Now, you invite Jesus in and he is a person, right? And he gives you one another. There's a reason that Jesus said over and over and over, love one another, love one another, love one another. Community matters. The third one there is get it out physically. Again, another thing I learned from my counselor, he said, you've got stuff inside of you that you've got to get out. How do you get it out physically? There are different ways to get out. Some of you know, if any of you follow me on Instagram or on Facebook, you know that I bake bread and I paint sometimes. That's actually one of the ways. There are other ways too. I have some artistic expression. I play the piano. I've started working out with my son in the mornings. There are physical ways. Sometimes we got him a punching bag. Sometimes he's out hitting that punching bag. Sometimes I think he's just getting out his emotions. I don't know. Is that true, Levi? Maybe? Yeah. Okay. Sometimes you got to get it out of your body. Because if it's in your body, it traumatizes you. You are an embodied soul. And the stuff that's impacting you impacts your body. And I won't go into all the studies, but a lot of the things that happen inside our bodies, everything from inflammation to cancer, is also attached to some of the trauma you've experienced. So move it out of your body somehow, find a way. If you need to learn how to paint watercolor, bake bread, I can help. Get it out physically. The last one, last two actually, go to Jesus. Seems simple, right? Like, you should just go to Jesus. No, I mean that. Jesus is alive. You can communicate with him. He will communicate with you. He will listen to you. He will bring healing to you. But you have to go to him. Go to him in prayer. Like David, the psalm, right? Like, enemies, trust God. You know, he's going to God. I'm wrestling with this, God. I have this burning inside of me. I have this anger inside of me. I have this depression. I can't get out of my bed. I'm in tears all day on my bed, he says in one of his psalms. Go to Jesus. Do it here in this room. Go to Jesus with your small group. Go to Jesus individually. Maybe you're journaling. Go to Gina. It's a great way to get it out of you too, is with your journaling. Go to Jesus in prayer. Go to Jesus in the scriptures. Go to Jesus in community. Go to Jesus. One way to go to Jesus, to get it out, to do community, all of those things, is something called the Kairos Circle. On your seat today, there's a piece of paper, and this is the Kairos Circle here. I am not going to explain this today, but here's what I will say. When you're walking along in life and something happens, it might be something really good in your life. It might be something really traumatic and bad. When something happens that's meaningful, spiritual people say, I wonder what God might be saying to me. And so the Kairos Circle is a way, if you're going down the highway of life, the Kairos Circle is a way to take an off-ramp and say, God, I wonder what you're saying to me in my life. I wonder what you're saying about my life and about me. And it gives you an opportunity to maybe take a different course on the highway. Do you understand what I'm saying? Too many of us just stay on the same highway, like Route 66 all the way across the country. And wouldn't it be nice to occasionally get off and see what's happening? And maybe you would end up in a different place. The Kairos Circle is a powerful tool. Many of the people here have used it in groups and are trained to use it with you. And if you want help doing it, it's well explained here. I would not do it alone to start. It's a great journal experience. But get with someone who can help you to ask the question, God, what are you saying to me? And what am I going to do about it? Powerful, practical tool. I would encourage you to do that. Abby, raise your hand. She was up here earlier. If you don't know Abby, Abby knows this thing back and forward, and she knows all the people here who know it. Well, not all of them, but she knows a lot of people who've been trained in it and who can help you with it. And if you would love to sit down and walk through it with someone because something's happened in your life and you need to wrestle with it, we'd love to walk through it with you. Let's pray. God, this is a really hard subject. I pray that the words I have spoken this morning have done some justice to it. Father, I pray that that we would learn from the examples in Scripture of those who have been traumatized and who have had the fruit of the Spirit poisoned in their hearts, like Sarah, like Hagar. I pray that we would learn from people like Abraham, and David and Solomon and others who have traumatized others, And that, God, we would choose the path of love and not the path of evil. For there are two ways. There are two ways. Psalm 1 reminds us that there are the ways that you've laid before us that lead to life. And there are the ways of the evil one that lead to death. God, we want to be on the path of life and love and prosperity and fruitfulness and goodness and fruitfulness. And God, I pray that you would help us to take just one next step. Maybe it's a baby step today. But I pray that each one of us would know, what's the next step I'm going to take? I'm going to tell somebody. I'm going to write a prayer to you, Jesus. I'm going to recognize some emotions and write those out in my journal. I'm going to read this paper on the Kairos Circle. I'm going to talk to somebody about walking me through it. God, I pray that you would meet us in the practical places of our lives and that we would see resurrection. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.